Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Hello and welcome to a brand new podcast. It's called Pilot Episodes and it's all about aviation. Now, anyone that has listened to me before will know I know nothing about aviation, flying, being a pilot. I can't do any of that. But I have teamed up with three guys that know absolutely everything about it. So I'm very lucky to be working with Dunk, Parky and Godders. We'll be doing it, well, we don't know how often we'll be doing it, but we'll be doing it frequently and we'll be doing it from various locations. This week we've done it from the RAF Museum in Hendon, and in the future we'll be doing it from, well, we don't actually know yet, but all over the country. So if you like what you hear today, please leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Twitter, and yeah, just keep your comments coming, because that's what's going to make us do more of these in the future. The next thing you're going to hear is the lads talking. They don't even realize that they're being recorded, and then we get into the episode. So enjoy it.
Airfield, small airfield, and I was like, I don't know what that is. And then that was the one when I came back and go,
what was it then? North of the M25.
I can't find it. It's like a phantom airfield. I've had a look on Google Earth.
North of the
I spent ages looking for it. Couldn't find it. It's a mystery. I could have been.
Are
anywhere.
We recording now?
Right. Well, you now get an insight into what these gentlemen are like. So, welcome to the podcast. We don't actually have a name for it. We don't know what we're doing, really. But we are sat here in the Air Museum. I think the best thing to do is probably just go around the table and introduce you gentlemen. So, first of all, Parky, introduce yourself.
So, I am just recently left the Royal Air Force. I was in for 33 years, and like my esteemed colleagues with me, just went fast jets right from the get-go. So 30 years of flying, a selection of fast jets.
30 years of flying. When was your first year of flying?
84, I did pilot training.
So when was I born? 8th or 4th? 84.
Yeah, there I was in the mighty tweet in Texas at the time. Yeah, and so, you know, I went, we'll banter this, but I went Air Defence. These boys went Harriers from pilot training. Phantoms, Tornado F3, F-16 on exchange, Red Arrows, got into the display world. I displayed the Tornado F3, and then we all met up on the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, flying Spit for Hurricane. And I flew the Eurofighter Typhoon, so I've had a good innings.
Don't do yourself down, mate. The first person on the planet to get 1,000 hours on Typhoon.
Yeah, is that right?
I chiselled the programme a lot to do that. Threw my name up on the board, yeah.
Yeah. And that voice you just heard then is Godders. How are you, mate?
Yeah, good. Yeah, glad to be here, finally. I've got the team together. We don't know whether it'll be any good. But yeah, so I joined the Air Force on the same day as Dunk, actually. 1991. January the 6th, 1991, wasn't it? I've just been a bit lucky since then. Flying Harriers out in Germany. Came back to the UK with them. Various ground tours, but we won't speak about them. Well, maybe we will.
Yeah, maybe we will.
No, we won't.
Along the way.
You can do that one on your own.
Yes, yeah, and that'll be a separate podcast. Did F-16 exchange out with the Americans, and then came back and flown Typhoon for most of the last sort of almost 15 years. A quick stint with these boys as the slightly worst pilot on the
That's like being the
nobody denied that.
There was just polite laughter.
Yeah, to be fair, that's like being the slowest man in the Olympic 100-metre final. So I wouldn't worry too much about that. And last but not least, Dunk, introduce yourself, please.
Well, I joined the Air Force with Goddess, both of us straight from school. So we went through officer training together, and then after flying training, I actually got...
You went twice through officer training.
I went twice through that, yeah. For lack of officer qualities, I can't believe it myself.
Is that
but
hair you had at the time?
I don't know.
Listening, Dan has some very short hair right now, but at the time... It was the biggest, floppiest hair I've ever seen.
Did have quite
Shouch,
a hair.
Wasn't it?
Shaved it all off, though, yep. Mind you.
After some has fallen out.
Some has fallen out. No, at the time.
Oh, okay.
Shaved it all off at the time. Yeah.
As if by magic.
Oh, fantastic. More batteries. Thank
I
you
don't
much.
Know how much power's in those.
We'll find out. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Do you want me to nip out and get a couple from Tesco's?
No, we'll be all right, thank you.
You sure?
Yeah, right. I'm pretty sure.
Thanks, Rebecca. We'll make it work. We'll make it work.
See you later.
Excellent, we've got some replacement batteries because I'm very prepared. So, so there you go. So, sorry, you were saying...
I was saying I had lots of hair.
Lots of hair.
We digressed a bit, didn't we? Everyone went through their flying career. We started to talk about my hair.
I think that's enough for you, to be honest. We've covered the highlights.
That's probably enough, isn't it?
Some flying in and out. Go, what did you
find? Well, I went through flying training, and at the end of Chivenet, I got sent to the F3 as well. So, however, I then had to hold for 2 years. And in that time, I flew Chipmunks for a year up at Edinburgh. And then I went and held Flying Hawks down at St Athan. And anyway, I went back to refresh after that. They had no space left on the F3. And they gave me a single seat rec, bizarrely. So I then got sent to the Harrier as well, sort of by a strange default. So I did Harriers in Germany, came back to the UK. Then I went to instruct... over at RAF Valley. So I did weapons tactics and flying instruction at Valley before being selected to go to the Reds. So I ended up being on the Reds with Parkey from 2003 to 2005.
Is that what we're calling it on here, by the way?
What?
The Reds.
It's going to be lots of inside chat. Yeah, Red Arrows, of course.
Air Force Aerobatic Display Team, 1998. The Red Arrows.
Something like that, yeah. So, yeah, you're right, the Red Arrows. And... after that, went back to the Harrier. So spent 4 or 5 years then on the Harrier. Some of that, I got selected, luckily enough, to go and fly BBMF. So I flew some of that flying the Harrier and a part-time flying Spitfires and Hurricanes, and then took over BBMF in 2013.
So BBMF, because of course we love our acronyms here, Battle of Britain Memorial Flight.
Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, yeah. So the Spitfire, Lancaster... Hurricane and Dakota, so there's 12 aircraft on the flight all in all, and I finished that in 2015, and then I now for my sins work for an organisation called Central Flying School, which is the oldest flying school in the world.
Is that right?
Yeah, and so I look after fast jet squadron, so anything to do with fast jet training, all the way from basic to Carno. We're soon going to have the Texan coming to the Royal Air Force, all the way up to looking at how the frontline operational conversion units do their business as well.
Crikey.
Did Dan get a longer introduction than us?
It's mostly
about seven times, really.
I think he took advantage of it more.
It was about my hair, mostly.
Yeah, well, it was that bit.
Talk about holding. I did loads of holding too.
The weird thing when Dunk, on the Reds when he joined, I was the exec, so as the exec you had this ridiculous...
Well, just exec.
Executive officer, but it was just
and
a title.
Red Arrows.
So it's just a title, but it meant that I could find the boys. So if their smokes were late, and it was just really, we sort of created a little bit of a fun just to have a beer at the end of the day. But I could make Dunk's life misery, and I'm sure I did.
You did.
And I had that power. And then weirdly, 7 years later, he's my boss. And that was when it was like, oh dear. Might have blown this.
The abused become the abuser.
It's like that sinking feeling when someone passes you on the squash ladder.
Exactly. Yeah.
So Red Arrows and Battle of Britain. How is that held? What kind of regard is that held in within flying circles? Is that ultimately where everyone aims to be, or is it a hobby, or is it something you want to do as extracurricular?
That's funny, isn't it?
That's a good question.
Not for everyone, but I reckon.
I never applied for the Reds. You know, I always really enjoyed. I loved watching the Reds. You know, I think all of us, you know, were sort of hooked on air shows when we were kids. But it was one of those things that I just wanted to. Going to fly Eurofighter. It was Eurofighter 2000 then, and turned out to Eurofighter when they didn't hit 2000 in terms of entry into service. But I wanted to go on exchange. I wanted to go and live in America. I wanted to go and see if I could fly something else. But almost, I'm the minority, almost every single other pilot I know in the Royal Air Force has fast jet pilot has applied to the Reds.
Yeah,
I applied, but I didn't. That's not why I joined the Air Force either. Do you know what? I had no interest in joining the Reds at all. Because when I was a boy, we wandered around the museum earlier, and yeah. I was saying to JB that actually there's a kitty hawk down there with a big shark's mouth on it. And, you know, I had a camera, an SLR camera, and that's what I would take photos of. I'd try and take pictures, which became a speck in the background when they became developed, of the World War II fighters. That's what interested me. And the only time that the reason I applied to the Reds was I just thought, when I was at Valley, well, I'm eligible to go and fly in a back seat. I may as well. It's a tick in the box of life. Why not? And then when I did, my jaw dropped, and I thought it was just completely not what I was expecting. It was amazing. So I then applied.
I remember doing the Phantom, the F4 conversion unit, and at the time I remember meeting a mate who was just off on exchange to fly the F-14 Tomcat, which is sort of the Top Gun movie jet. It was brilliant. I remember thinking, I had no real idea that in the RAF, you know, all I wanted to be was, you know, fighter pilot, just get onto a fast jet, fly the Phantom, fantastic. And really, I think a bit like God, as my aim then turned into how can I get an exchange? And I didn't know, you know, there were some tasty other jets around, you know, F-18s and 16s and Mirages and all sorts. And it's a bit of a lottery as to which one you got. But I remember I got F-16 in Holland, Goddard's got it in the States. But that was it. That I just wanted to get my stickies and to fly with another Air Force. It just seems such a brilliant idea and a great sort of 3 years to fly out, you know, as a guest in another nation. And really then from there, a bit like Dunk, you know, I thought the Reds was, you know, completely out of my league. I didn't think I'd have shouted it, flew with the team, and, you know, absolutely got hooked. And I'm sure you were, Goddard, if things had panned out differently, you'd have loved it.
I was amazed when I did go flying with them. I think the only time I went flying with the team was when a friend of ours, Matt Jarvis, unfortunately died of cancer. I mean, a long time ago now, wasn't it?
2005.
Yeah, 2005.
Cool. There we go.
That's him.
That's weird. Yeah. Jarvo was listening to us.
Yeah.
They did a thing where Jarvo had been selected for the Reds and ended up getting cancelled when they're out doing their spring training, that you call it, wasn't it? You know, good weather training out in Cyprus. You know, unfortunately, couldn't fly after that. And one thing, it was terminal cancer, and one thing that he wanted to do was fly in a Spit. So they brought a two-seat Spit up to Scampton. Were you in the team? Were you in the Reds?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, brought a two-seat Spit up to Scampton, invited us, a load of us along to go and sit in the back. And I think they did it, you know, they may have done a display in the morning, but I remember sitting in the display just going, I don't believe this. This is utterly ridiculous how close all of you guys are flying. That's why I was tending to spend most of my BB time now. How close you guys were flying. And thinking it was flipping amazing. I mean, you know, and in fact, that was an amazing day of being sat in the back of one of the Red Hawks and seeing Jarvo sat in the back of a two-seat Spit, because I'd loved Spitfires all my life, but I'd never flown with one.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on that particular day, got both of them. I didn't think I'd be sat in a Spitfire later on, maybe, as well.
It was quite an incredible day, wasn't it, though? You know, all of his mates that weren't on the team, weren't flying on the team, were, and given, you know, he'd been on the team for a year and a half at that point. Just because he got ill during his first season's workup. But of course, to us, he was still on the team, still part of the team as he went through that illness. But all of his friends that weren't on the team at the time, he had all of his mates in the front seat of the jets, but all of the guys that he knew throughout the Air Force, we came and flew as many of them in the back seat of the jets as well. So he literally had his sort of whole Air Force family there, didn't he? And it was an incredible emotional day.
Yeah, and so the other thing as well, Parker, you mentioned, you know, I think I probably would have looked at it, but, you know, especially having seen, you know, really good mates of mine like Dunk, or, you know, Davy Slow, guys like that.
But you got promoted.
The Reds. Well, it is one of those things, isn't it? You know, I definitely.
Window closed.
It's a window shut, but I don't look back thinking, well, I wish I'd managed to fly on the Reds because of all the
you
other
should
stuff
do.
Like that.
It's probably a lie.
He's got to play for the
Have we got a lie detector thing?
The recording machine is used twice.
What is different about display flying compared to operational flying?
The solo display I did with the Tornado F3 99 2000, so that's a while ago. But obviously every part of military flying, and to be honest, flying in general, is clearly lots of regulations, lots of rules, and you adhere to them. And it's one of those things when you first get clear to display height, so you're legally allowed to 100 feet, you're inverted at 500 feet, so it's low. That is so A-level compared to all the other flying you've done. You know, you just are not allowed to go upside down in an aircraft.
And you're not?
Not at those heights, not ridiculously close to the ground. And to my mind, it's just that feeling of, I cannot believe this is legal. But it clearly was, and you've worked down to it, and with the red arrows as well, you know, every... You know, that first month of training when you, you know, you just, you loop and you roll, and then you start to move formations, and then you learn the second half manoeuvres. I would be flying thinking, I cannot believe I'm doing this, you know. And then the weird thing probably for all of us is what is absolutely A-level and so incredibly amazing becomes the norm. And that really is, and display flying, it, you know, it does, and you obviously you're concentrating on flying the aircraft. But I remember the first bit of display flying, it really is.
Did you do
unbelievable
before you did Reds?
Yeah, went straight from F3 to Reds, yeah.
Because that's interesting, because both of you had that display experience, didn't you? Whereas...
I didn't.
No, but when you came to BVMF...
Oh,
example,
yeah.
And,
not before the Reds.
So your third trip in a Hurricane was going upside down in it at display height.
Yeah. You know, that was the most amazing thing to me. And it was I had a super crazy week where I'd come back from operations on the Saturday... Sunday, I had to. I think I had a day off. Monday, I requalified in the Chipmunk, the little training aeroplane we've got on BBMF. Tuesday, I did my flying test on the Chipmunk. And bear in mind, I hadn't flown for 3 or 4 weeks before this. 4 weeks is how long I've been away. Wednesday, after I'd done the flying test, we did Hurricane Ground School, and I did the run where you start the Merlin when it's strapped down at the back, they tie it down just so you don't go launching off into the distance or the tail doesn't lift and you strike a prop, all these sorts of things. Thursday, went down to Duxford, flew the Harvard twice, once in the back, once in the front, or it's the other way around actually, I think, once in the front, once in the back, and flew it back to Coningsby. Friday, went solo in the Hurricane for the first time. Saturday morning, did a 500-foot display in the Hurricane. Saturday afternoon, did a 100-foot display in the Hurricane. All in a week, never having had any sort of previous display experience before. They've been amazing.
Yep.
You know, I don't know whether it was similar in the, you know, it's quite a considered workup in the Reds, and I'd done a lot of that chipmunk flying beforehand as well. But what intense.
Now that
week,
is intense. Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
And almost dreamlike. Is this really happening or is it?
So yeah. I was mowing the lawn on the Sunday, got back from ops. I was mowing the lawn again on the Sunday a week later, going, have I just woken up from a coma?
Yeah.
Did I dream that I was flying a Hurricane?
Well, the thing is as well that maybe we should talk about it as a separate subject, but the interesting thing about going through that workup is the fact that for all of us, I think, was the case that it was the first aircraft and you get into that Hurricane.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That you've flown, that you've not had a two-seat version of some type, it is effectively you've sat in it in the ground and that's it, and then you start it up, you get it airborne, and you know that actually landing it
is definitely going to be exciting. It's very different to, you know, the inertia that the thing's got, the power that it's got, and the reputation that it's got in terms of the difficulties that you can have landing it. Notwithstanding,
difficulties in
another time. But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the Air Force has come full circle now. Now we're looking at F-35. We're looking at Typhoon. Typhoon's going to lose pretty much all of its two seaters. And soon, although we've got synthetics that we didn't have in the Hurricane,
but the sim is brilliant.
The sim is fantastic. And that's the point. But you know, it has gone full circle, hasn't it? The first time, I don't think it'll take away from that excitement and that feeling
when you
sit in that, you know, multi-million-pound single-seat jet for the first time, not just a simulator.
That's when your brains drop out of your head. You know, why they did the Hurricane tie down, start the engine, because you forget everything as soon as that massive Merlin engine is screaming away in front of you. It's the same in any fast jet, isn't it?
Mm.
If you're going in it for the first time, you know, they say you lose half of your capacity once you strap into it, because, you know, it's the... a bit of excitement, I suppose, and a bit of nerves about flying that aeroplane for the first time on your own. No one there to, you know, to give you a helping hand. You know, it's all down to you.
If you've flown before, well, obviously you've flown a lot before, and you're flying these high-tech systems, how much of a shock is it when you've got to go into something which was built 60, 70 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, the shock is they're noisy. They've just got so much character. They are utterly, utterly brilliant. But... it is that what if. I mean, the actual aircraft, once you get it airborne, they fly beautifully. Spitfire's gorgeous to fly, you know, and it is almost like any aircraft, you know, left is left, right is right, up, down, you know, that bit of it. But it's just certainly the landing. Tail dragger has all of its own nuances because it's got a little tail wheel, so it hasn't got a nose wheel. So essentially,
that's a niche episode.
you can't see where when you're landing, whereas every other aircraft we've flown, you can see the runway, you can point at it, whereas when you land up, certainly a Spitfire and in the flare in the Hurricane, you cannot see ahead. The nose is in the way. So that build up and that knowledge is a frightening thing that's just preying on your mind as you jump into the Hurricane for the first time. And you'd definitely be nervous. The most nervous I ever was, I think, was...
I was just going to ask you about that. I can't remember. I must have been nervous the first time the instructor got out when I was in a Cessna when I was 17, you know, and said, right, off you go on your own. You're kind of bulletproof when you're 17, but I do remember being, you know, mid-30s, late 30s on BBMF, being massively nervous as I taxied out, and probably because of that standard thing that Smithy says to you before you get in that, you know, if you're going to crash it, make sure you kill yourself. because, you know, it's a flying museum piece more than anything. And there's something about fulfilling that boyhood dream, you know, because it sounds ridiculous to say, doesn't it? But, you know, just flying around the place generally, although it never gets old, it's flipping brilliant. It's a job, you know, that is your job. That's what you do every day, and it's hard work.
For me, I think, you know, that feeling, there's, you know, a sliding scale of intensity of that feeling. But to me, if I try and remember back, I think that same feeling, it's really difficult to describe what it is, but it is a mix of nerves and excitement and, right, this is all down to you now. You could really screw this up if you don't get this right. And, you know, some aeroplanes, Hurricane is right on the right-hand end of the scale, and equally then the Spitfire, once you graduate from the Hurricane, you've done that a little bit, and then you go in to get into one of the Spitfires, particularly the baby ones, the small ones that really could be very exciting when you put them down on the runway. I think those are on the right-hand side of the scale.
I do remember my feet were shaking on the pedals when I landed the Hurricane for the first time, actually. You know,
I mean, we could see that from the tower.
Trembling.
And then, you know, whoever it was on the radio, right, turn around, go and do it again. Well, I've just survived that one. Can we just not call it a day there? I'll retire now.
How old are these things to maintain? You guys must be some of the few people, probably in the world actually, with experience in these aircraft. Who fixes them? Who actually has the expertise nowadays?
It depends where you are. So certainly from BBMF, so we've said it's Battle of the Memorial Flight, so certainly that unit has its own Royal Air Force engineers that are specialists in maintaining those aircraft. It's a very small team. It's about 27, 28 engineers that look after that. Some of them we've kept as full-time reservists, so they've been on the unit for some of them 25 years to try and maintain that experience. Incredibly experienced Merlin engine experts and airframe experts that stay on the BBMF to have that continuity through. But equally, you'll also have guys that come straight out of training and they'll get posted to BBMF.
Is that right?
Yep, and they'll learn that trade and then they'll go away and they'll be whatever engineering type, they'll go and do that on Typhoon, they'll go on Ops. They've, once they've got that BBMF engineering experience, they might find as they're promoted, they're brought back into BBMF at a slightly, you know, higher level, a slightly higher supervisory level for them, and so that they can sort of continue through then. But there's a real mix of experts. And then when you go out into Civvy Street, again, there's guys that have got into that world and they've stayed in that world, and you've got some very highly skilled engineers and operators out in the civilian world that operate vintage aircraft, and hopefully we'll have one or two of them on as guests.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
So is Paul Blackett still on flight?
He is. He's still there.
So this is a guy who, 25 years plus, who has to be probably a world expert, if not the world expert, on maintaining these things.
Yeah.
You reckon?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's interesting talking to him as well, because some of those young, I mean, what a massive opportunity for, you know, a 17 or 18 year old to join the Air Force, do their engineering training, yeah, and get posted to the Battle of Britain Memorial flight. But what was interesting chat to these guys is, because, you know, some kids join as engineers because they've always wanted to be engineers, you know, so have always changed their own brake pads on a car and this, that and the other. But there's other kids just joined because that was the vacancy at the careers office at the time. And so, you know, for these people, teaching them a level of engineering that is completely different to what happens on a Typhoon squadron or a, you know, Tornado squadron or helicopters, is interesting, you know, in the fact that it's all just, it's fabric, it's wood, it's aluminium, you know, the engines, proper old, big old engines. And just seeing those guys sort of progress through there and then come back, you know, every now and again if they are interested in it, is fucking amazing. But
I was there on Friday, actually. I was at BBMF on Friday doing some flying with them in the Chipmunk, and one of the guys that was a corporal there when I joined 7 years before, I'd just come back as a chief technician, so, you know, three ranks further up, to come back. It's like, hey, how you doing, you know? And people just migrate back to it. I think, you know, we can't really talk for the outside civilian contractors that do this stuff, but there is absolutely a love for these aeroplanes. You grow to love the aeroplanes, and the ground crew are the same. They often have their particular favourite that they'll have, and that they just, you know, they sometimes, you know, when you were down route and there was something wrong with the aeroplane, you had to order them to stop working on it, because, you know, they would just work every hour God sent. And, you know, we have rules that says that we have to have a certain amount of rest, and you'd have to say, boy, you've got to stop, because the commitment and enthusiasm that they had to those aeroplanes and their want to fix them, to see them fly again, was just outstanding, wasn't it?
All the more responsibility not to break them then.
I guess so, yeah.
Even though I tried a couple of times. Again, one for another episode.
Yeah.
Keep that one as a teaser.
We all had exciting moments.
How do you go about designing a display flight?
The BBMF's display is, you know, God has, as he said, you know, on his third trip he's flying it. So it's a pretty safe display. So, you know, there's only certain manoeuvres you do. You know, we'll do rolls. In the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, we tend not to loop the fighters, so we limit.
Why is that then?
Because if you know, gate heights at the top of loops, essentially, if you don't make that gate height or you're too fast and you pull to 90 nose down, the ground is there. So, you know, burying the nose, it's just a far more of an A-level manoeuvre to do.
Yeah.
And you can still display a Spitfire and a Hurricane Royal Air Force Battle of Britain Memorial flight without having to do that. We do vertical manoeuvres, but we don't pull through off the loops, etc. So
I think the other thing to say about that, though, as well, is just to cut in, is that it's a strange environment on BBMF, because well, although we'll have a bunch of experience, the boss in his final year will have done at least 7 years. Parky did 9 or 10?
11.
11. 11 years. It seemed longer. But yeah,
no,
you know.
You're working with him. It was,
oh, my God. Hard. I know. Yeah. An eon. But anyway, the fact is you also have OC Ops, like Goddard's was, and station commanders that might only fly it for a year or two. And so they don't, you know, as Goddard's was just describing, don't have that display experience. And so we wouldn't want to put people in that environment with, you know, a limited amount of display experience, yeah, where they're putting themselves into a position where, with just the wrong... a wrong read of an altimeter when you're upside down and there's all sorts of other things going on can put you into a very dangerous position. So, you know, the decision was made long ago that that's not something that we felt that we wanted or needed to do.
And it makes the aeroplanes last longer as well.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, the more G-force you're putting in these things, the more stress they're under. You know, they're old aeroplanes, you know, they're taken apart, put back together quite, like, was it once every...
Four majors, 8 years, something like that.
Yeah, once every 10, 4, 5, 6, however many years it is. But if you just fly gently, they'll last forever. You know, the hub, what was the saying you used to have as the boss tank? That, you know, we've been around for 70 years and, you know, with a bit of love and attention, they'll be around for the next 70 years minimum.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they could be forever. You know, yeah. There was a guy called Mike Kidd who was one of the engineers, worked on the civilian side, and he very cleverly put in place a system that meant that as long as there's a public will to see the aeroplane, they can, in theory, fly forever because it's a Royal Air Force unit, and the maintenance scheme means that their life, their fatigue life, if you like, parts are replaced such that their fatigue life will never run out. So as long as there's the public will to see them, and, you know, fingers crossed there always will be, we should be able to fly them forever.
Does a memorial flight ever get bigger? As in, do you acquire new aircraft?
Yeah. It's rare, but yeah. So, yeah. Did you fly the Mark 16 for the first time? No, Smithy did, didn't he? But then you took over as boss.
Yeah,
so,
exactly, yeah.
You know, again, Paul Blacker we mentioned, but the boys, you know, essentially in their lunch breaks, etc., they acquired an airframe, a fuselage, and they built Airworthy over about 11 years,
really?
A Mark 16 Spitfire. And we watched this thing in the hangar slowly, you know, grow wings and get painted and da-da-da. And then eventually the day came in December... 12, that Smithy took an airborne, and then Dunk flew it, I flew it, and that, you know, she was a, I think she hadn't flown for 55 years, it was something like that, it was remarkable.
And it wasn't an actual original aircraft, it was lots of other pieces, was it?
Well, no, it was an original airframe, it restored, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah, big day.
And, you know, throughout the history of the flight, I mean, the flight started with one Hurricane and three Spits. Again, I'm sure, you know, we could go into that another time, but effectively at the time it was late 50s that it started, the maintenance wasn't quite there. They had a few problems with aeroplanes where the engine stopped, and you know, they had some exciting times for sure. But over the years, then the aeroplanes were, you know, there was more and more Spitfires were added, and then of course the Lancaster came to the BBMF.
Well, where did you find a Lancaster from?
Well, that, you know, that again is a, it was an aeroplane that was done. It was the last flying one it had. I think it came in. Did it come in?
No, she was at Henlow.
Henlow, not Tendon.
And they managed to get one flight because she was going to be a gate guard at Waddington.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was a bit of a ruse. Actually, let's keep her flying. And then they did a couple of trips. She was a massive hit at the air shows. And then, you know, acquired by the BBMF, 73, 74,
yeah, wasn't it?
And that's, you know, every aircraft, and certainly civilian world, has just got the most amazing story how it survived.
Yeah.
You know, 20-odd thousand Spitfires were built. There's maybe 60 in the world, circa something like that. So, you know, it's just ridiculous how few survived, but each of them will have an amazing story how it's still going.
Have any of you boys seen the documentary about the B-29 that they found in the North Pole?
No. And it eventually went on ice, caught fire, and
oh my god! Yeah. I didn't know the end of this story. I assumed that they got out safely. So, I think 90 minutes of my life invested into this B-29 getting out, heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. I recommend anyone listening go on YouTube, find that video. But you know what, lads, we've done 31 minutes. Well done, your first podcast. How's that feel?
We haven't even started yet.
Well, I don't. Although I've run out of stuff to say.
You're banging on about getting scared again, weren't you?
That's what we discovered in this podcast.
Well, we've not decided on a name yet. We don't even have a Twitter account, but when we do, we will let you know. Until we release another podcast, well, we'll see you then. Right, gents, see you later.
See you.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.